Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of drug use, sexual abuse, and suicide that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
In the early morning darkness covering Setauket, Long Island, Constable Robert Bell began his morning patrol by the beach. He walked slowly at first, enjoying the crisp air and the sound of waves lapping against the shore.
But once the crop of enormous mansions lining Oldfield Road was in sight, the constable stopped in his tracks. Something was off. Usually the houses would all be dark at this hour, but one of them was lit like a beacon.
Constable Bell adjusted his course and made his way toward the shining lights. Soon, his suspicions were confirmed. The gates in front of the massive house were wide open. Something strange was going on.
Bell reached the door and yelled out for the mansion's owner. No one answered. Then he called the caretaker of the estate, Malcolm Wade, who gave him permission to look around.
The constable proceeded quietly through the spacious entryway. In spite of the open door and blinding lights, nothing seemed to be missing or out of place. He felt his heart pound as he walked along the creaky hall to a downstairs bedroom. Inside, he found a woman lying eerily still on the bed.
Bell struggled to wake the barely conscious woman. When he finally succeeded, she unleashed a panicked stream of babble he could barely understand. Her lover was gone. Where? Into the icy water below them. He'd plunged himself into the Long Island Sound.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults, a Parcast original. Every Tuesday, we take a look at a cult's practices, their leader, and their followers. You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Cults for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
Today, in a one-part episode, we're taking a deep dive into the Rama cult, founded by software guru Frederick Lenz. The organization, founded in 1981, operated in the Los Angeles and tri-state areas until 1998.
Lenz referred to himself as Rama and taught a mix of Buddhism, Hinduism, and shamanism to hundreds of his followers. He claimed to be able to lead them to wealth and enlightenment, but has been accused of psychologically manipulating and abusing those who trusted him most.
Frederick P. Lenz III was born in 1950. He spent his formative years in Connecticut and experienced a somewhat turbulent early life.
Lenz's mother had problems with alcohol, while his father worked in marketing and would later become mayor of Stamford. They divorced while Lenz was still young, and Lenz felt himself suddenly caught in two completely different worlds.
Looking for a way to deal with the stress, Lenz discovered meditation in high school. Some days to avoid school, he would, in his own words, lie on the floor and put himself in a trance.
It's likely that these trances helped Lenz escape, not only from school, but also from his polarized home life.
Vanessa is going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. According to researchers at Arizona State University, conflict between parents is strongly correlated with negative paternal relationships. If Lenz's parents didn't get along, their strife could have also damaged the boy's relationship with his father. Well into adulthood, Lenz actively distanced himself from his dad, and their personal relationship remained strained for many years.
On the other hand, Lenz described his mother as the center of his world. Though he now spent much of his time under the custody of his father, she was his favorite. Unfortunately, she passed away in 1964, when Lenz was only 14. To deal with his grief, Lenz once again turned to solitude and meditation.
Meditating is a common method for dealing with emotional strain, but some studies, including one conducted by the Cochrane Library, have suggested that more research is needed to determine whether meditation reduces clinical distress more than other techniques. Though Lenz looked to meditation for solace, it's possible it never fully quelled his inner demons.
It did serve to distinguish Lenz from his peers, however. His classmates in high school often referred to the 17-year-old as Crazy Fred. Their yearbook described Lenz as having a streak of the unusual, chasing the beautiful, hiding from the known.
This chase for the beautiful led Lenz west to San Francisco after high school, where he mingled with hippies in the Haight-Ashbury district. But he wasn't there for long before he was arrested for selling marijuana.
As usual, Lenz dealt with his latest setback through quiet reflection. During a subsequent stint in a San Diego work camp, he was frequently observed sitting completely motionless in his cell, staring at the wall.
Lenz was in the work camp for about a year before he was released, supposedly through the influence of his politically connected father. According to Lenz, he moved to Kathmandu in Nepal for a while, where he began studying under a Tibetan Buddhist monk.
Tibetan Buddhism adheres to the basic tenets of Buddhism, contending that life is suffering and one should seek to escape the cycle of rebirth through enlightenment.
However, there are some specific elements of Tibetan Buddhism that may have appealed to Lenz. While other Buddhist sects teach that it takes many lifetimes for an individual to attain enlightenment, Tibetan Buddhists believe people can reach nirvana in a single lifetime. The sect also emphasizes a strong relationship between its teachers and disciples.
The Buddhist monk and Lenz supposedly grew very close in a short amount of time. Lenz later claimed that the monk said he'd been waiting for longer than a single lifetime for Lenz to come to him. He said that in the future, Lenz would become a spiritual leader and reach millions of people.
Flush with new purpose, Lenz moved back to Connecticut to go to college. While he was in school, he met Queens-based guru Sri Chinmoy, whose Hinduism-inspired lifestyle teachings had gained him a large following among young people.
Chinmoy taught many meditative techniques. Unlike some Hindu sects, he didn't order his followers to renounce all earthly things in favor of the divine. Instead, he preached that one should maintain a healthy physical body, adhere to a vegetarian diet, and embrace a celibate lifestyle.
Lenz became a devout follower of Chinmoy. With his predilection for meditation, as well as his alleged study in the Himalayas, it's easy to see how he found Chinmoy appealing.
In 1971, in the throes of passion, he even married a like-minded flower child named Pamela. The marriage dissolved after a year, but 21-year-old Lenz's commitment to his new religion stayed strong.
He stayed in Chinmoy's group throughout college, maintaining his faith while juggling a rigorous course load. By 1979, the 29-year-old had earned a PhD in English literature and was relatively high up in Chinmoy's organization.
Chinmoy appreciated Lenz's dedication and talent for recruiting others. He even allowed Lenz to bend the rules, tolerating his followers' sexual relationships and love of violent movies.
He found his faith in Lenz rewarded after the new professor used his position at Stony Brook University to promote meditation sessions. During the sessions, he convinced many of his students to become followers of Chinmoy themselves.
In 1979, Chinmoy sent Lenz to San Diego to manage and grow a small group of his followers who had settled there, but he vastly underestimated Lenz's ambition.
After a few years of recruitment, Lenz had amassed around 100 dedicated disciples. By that point, many of their followers in San Diego were more loyal to Lenz than Chinmoy, since he'd been the one speaking to them on a daily basis. In 1981, he had all of them go on a 13-day fast. After they were delirious from lack of food, Lenz dropped a bombshell. He suddenly declared, "Chinmoy has fallen, and I am now the Enlightened One."
Following this announcement, Lenz began proclaiming that he was Rama, an avatar of the Hindu god Vishnu. He said he remembered every single one of his previous reincarnations, including his tenures as a Zen master in ancient Japan and a high priest in the lost city of Atlantis.
They agreed to split off from Chinmoy, and Lenz officially founded his new sect. He incorporated his newfound organization as Lakshmi, named after the Hindu goddess of pursuing one's goals.
Over the next several years, Lenz brought more and more people into the fold and started reworking Chinmoy's ideas into a religion that suited him better.
His first major departure was to convert his sect to be based more in the Buddhist tradition rather than Hindu. He now urged his followers to seek enlightenment rather than personal balance.
But in an unusual move, Lenz also claimed that enlightenment was tied to material success. The newly proclaimed Rama melded the selflessness of Buddhist teachings with ideas of American exceptionalism.
As a result, members of his group believed that they could not only shed the shackles of the material world, but that they could do it while becoming successful, rich, and powerful.
Day to day, members continued to lead relatively independent lives, gathering together once a month to hear Lenz speak. Many joined meditation groups, where they practiced Lenz's mindfulness exercises. Some went on long fasts and excursions to deserts, where they would further practice meditation.
Thanks to his tireless recruitment and academic background, Lenz soon had a stable income from lecture tours at colleges. He was so successful that he was able to financially support his sect and even rent massive houses where his followers would gather for extravagant parties.
As his following grew, so did his renown. Some members claimed that he levitated while meditating. Others believed that he could change his face at will. And still others recall seeing a golden light emanate from his body.
Whether these were divine experiences, overblown rumors, or drug-distorted fantasies is unclear. But no matter how the stories gained traction, it was clear that Lenz had a unique magnetism to many people.
His teachings especially appealed to young people. He even proclaimed to be an early feminist. He declared that men had subjected women to sexual slavery in society, and that women were better at meditating. He believed that enlightenment could only be achieved through the feminine side of oneself.
These ideas struck a chord amongst the youth of the early 80s, as did Lenz's focus on technology.
At the time, jobs in tech were becoming increasingly lucrative. Lenz was impressed by the explosion of career opportunities in California and began to capitalize on it. He started teaching seminars in coding and computer science, though it's unclear when he gained his expertise in these areas.
His focus on the tech industry coincided with a new business model for his sect. Since he was grooming people for financial success, Lenz decided he deserved a cut of the profits. He began charging people for his seminars, which for years had been free. At first, the classes started as low as $7, but the prices would eventually surge to the detriment of the followers, but to the great benefit of the guru.
To a number of outward observers, the Zen master Rama and his followers were simply a novelty, a byproduct of the Eastern-inspired religion craze of the late 70s. But as years wore on, Lenz would reveal a darker side of his cult to the world.
When we return, people start to speak out about the Rama's misdeeds. And now, back to the story.
After training under Hindu master Sri Chinmoy, 31-year-old Dr. Frederick Lenz founded his own Buddhist sect in 1981. He renamed himself Zen Master Rama and declared that he was enlightened. Over the next few years, he set about recruiting people at college campuses and seminars and began charging his devotees for classes in computer science.
In 1985, the 35-year-old Lenz rebranded his Los Angeles-based organization from Lakshmi to Rama Seminars and began more aggressively advertising his lectures and classes. He claimed that he had led many past lives, and all his experience enabled him to put his followers on the fast track to enlightenment.
But his idea of enlightenment was anything but traditional. Behind closed doors, Lenz fully indulged in his hedonistic lifestyle, embracing free love and psychedelic drugs at highly secretive get-togethers with his followers.
All the partying came with consequences. In the months and years afterward, he became more unpredictable and megalomaniacal, with his mood swinging from excessive friendliness to startling aggression.
The drugs affected Lenz's temperament, but they also likely helped him recruit many followers in the first place.
According to Dr. Humphrey Osmond, drugs such as LSD can create a religious experience. Those using such drugs feel a transcendence of time and space that's sometimes believed to be an experience of the infinite. In his book on psychedelics, Dr. Humphrey Osmond describes an experiment in which several Christian subjects were given psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, and listened to a 2.5-hour broadcast of a Good Friday service. After the experiment, 80% of participants reported improved religious and spiritual lives over the subsequent 6 months. With such drugs acting as gateways to divinity, it's easy to see why followers could accept Lenz as a prophet.
The more people bought into his movement, the more Frederick Lenz profited. Early on, he charged his followers only small amounts, approximately $7, to attend his lectures. But once the group began growing, he charged more and more.
Eventually, he was charging his followers thousands of dollars to attend the seminars. By the end of 1985, Lenz had an estimated annual income of more than $5 million.
All that money eventually drew controversy. In the late 80s, his former followers accused Lenz of financial abuse. He lived a lavish life, while many of his devotees were saddled with debt. But ultimately, this was among the least damaging of Lenz's actions.
In the mid-80s, a UCLA student and follower of Lenz died by suicide. He left behind a note that simply said, "Bye, Rama. See you next time."
We'll never know conclusively if Lenz's teachings directly caused the young man's death. But the implications seem to be that the student was seeking reincarnation of some sort and associated that reincarnation with Lenz. No charges were ever filed following the incident.
In 1986, another of Lenz's followers overdosed on morphine after giving the Rama $100,000. He was discovered unclothed, sitting in a lotus position. In this case, there was no evidence that the man intentionally ended his life, but the tragic event brought even more negative attention to Lenz's organization.
Families and friends of his supporters criticized what they believed was the exploitation of their loved ones. Legal experts started to view Lenz not as the man behind a New Age Buddhist sect, but rather a dangerous cult leader.
Lenz was personally offended by the backlash. In interviews around this time, one follower claimed that practicing meditation in America was like being Jewish in Nazi Germany. But Lenz couldn't pretend to be a victim for long.
In 1987, the perception of Lenz as a New Age feminist was abruptly shattered when two of his former followers accused the Zen master of sexual abuse.
Annie Eastwood said that the guru had invited her over to his Malibu residence for a so-called private meditation session. There, he had pulled out a loaded pistol on her and raped her at gunpoint. Mercedes Hughes, another follower, said that Lenz had seduced her in Los Angeles, plying her with LSD to manipulate her into having sex. The two women publicly denounced Lenz to the media, though neither filed criminal charges.
A third woman named Barbara Sherman had a similar experience to Hughes. She joined the cult at the age of 18 and, like many of his other followers, took computer courses and passed the bulk of her earnings along to Lenz to attend his workshops.
She was eventually invited to Lenz's personal residence, where she was drugged with hallucinogens. In her words, Lenz then proceeded to have his way with her for 3 days before casually kicking her out of his house.
Others reported that Lenz fostered a culture in his cult where having sex with the guru was considered a positive, almost essential act. One even claimed that Lenz had referred to his semen as liquid enlightenment.
Lenz immediately denied the accusations, saying that the encounters with these women and any female members of his organization were completely consensual.
He declared that members of his group were merely exploring so-called tantric sex as a means to enlightenment. He also compiled a 107-page rebuttal document on all the people who had denounced him. He referred to many as mentally unstable and untrustworthy. During this time, people familiar with Lenz said that he became so stressed and depressed that he began losing his hair.
The sexual allegations and suspicious deaths were not the only bad press that Rama had to shake off. Those that left the cult told journalists that Frederick Lenz dictated almost every aspect of his followers' lives.
Some in Lenz's group said they were expected to report to him about what they wore and what movies they watched. They were also encouraged to limit their ties with those not involved in the cult.
As the damning reports piled up, the bad publicity caused a massive shift in the way the Rama conducted business. Flyers and advertisement for Lenz's seminars, lectures, and classes stopped making direct references to the guru. Instead, they hid behind names like Advanced Systems Incorporated, Infinity Plus Incorporated, or Hartford Meditation Society.
In the fall of 1987, 37-year-old Lenz uprooted his entire operation to flee the controversy. He moved his base from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., saying that God was calling him there to oversee the coming elections. Then, soon after, he moved again to New York, taking some of his core followers along with him. Though the group was slightly fractured, the Rama cult now had members on both the East and the West Coast.
For a while, Lenz disappeared from the news. He waited for the storm to blow over and then quietly continued giving lectures and seminars. Over the next few years, he managed to rebuild his base of support. But wherever he went, controversy eventually followed.
In the spring of 1991, a New York business magazine warned tech companies to start checking the references of their local hires very thoroughly. Some major businesses had recently started to run into problems, thanks to Frederick Lenz.
For years, one of the core teachings of the Rama was that his followers must succeed financially. To this end, he'd encouraged his devotees to take courses in computer science and coding for the usual fee of thousands of dollars per course.
Some of the Rama's followers who studied computers founded lucrative software companies, such as Auto Systems and Team Alliance. Some of these companies even gave up to 50% of their financial earnings to Lenz as a tribute.
But other followers aimed to join existing software companies rather than to start their own. Many were under immense pressure from Lenz, as he often told his supporters that if they didn't get a job, they only had themselves to blame.
In desperation to please their guru, some members of the cult started to falsify their resumes. They began fraudulently listing other cult members as references, some of whom owned major companies and lied on their companions' behalf.
It was so important for Lenz's devotees to fulfill his expectation of financial success that they were willing to lie to achieve it. While this might seem extreme, it wasn't only Lenz's approval they were seeking. Studies have shown that our job performance can be deeply linked to our self-esteem. A meta-analysis of studies from the Journal of Applied Psychology in 2001 suggested a possible correlation between people's success at work and their self-worth. It wasn't just about getting Lenz's validation, it was also about validating themselves, even if it was based on a lie. Lenz seized on his followers' insecurities and subjected them to massive emotional strain.
Moreover, Lenz allegedly encouraged such creative resume doctoring. After all, according to him, habitual meditation made the minds of his followers sharper than the average person's. Therefore, companies would benefit from the energy his followers would bring to the workplace, regardless of whether they were actually as experienced as they claimed to be.
Unfortunately, this didn't prove to be the case. Some of these hires caused significant problems at their new companies. For instance, in 1991, the Deutsche Bank of Frankfurt hired Alan Goldstein, a RAMA member, to be a project manager. Goldstein then hired other inexperienced RAMA members to fill out the team.
It soon became clear that many of the team members were completely unqualified. At first, the work progressed slowly. Then, not at all.
The company was even more appalled when they discovered that the RAMA members had been feeding Frederick Lenz classified information about the project. He required his followers to fax him every month with updates on their lives, and some of the confidential information regarding Deutsche Bank's reorganization ended up being disclosed.
Though Goldstein denied that there was a data breach of any sort, the project was quickly shut down. Occurrences like this weren't uncommon, and Lenz's followers gained a bad reputation for being inexperienced and unreliable. The gossip snowballed, eventually leading to the magazine article.
In response to the exposé, Lenz's lawyers attempted to get the magazine to rescind their reporting, calling it oppression of religious beliefs. The plot failed, but as the smoke cleared, Frederick Lenz still stood tall. It seemed no amount of bad press could topple his empire, but he wouldn't remain untouchable forever.
When we return, we learn the dramatic fate of Frederick Lenz. And now, the conclusion of the story.
Frederick Lenz rose rapidly to prominence in the 80s when he declared that he was a reincarnated Zen master who could lead others to enlightenment. But the foundation of his cult was shaken to its core when former members accused 37-year-old Lenz of sexual and financial abuse.
Lenz was knocked down, but not out. Over the course of the late 80s, he rebuilt his movement. He continued to run a successful lecture circuit, which he used to milk his followers out of thousands of dollars.
Then in 1995, 45-year-old Lenz published his first book, Surfing the Himalayas, A Spiritual Adventure. This novel was a fictionalized version of his experiences, studying under a Tibetan Buddhist master.
The book's publication was controversial. There were still reports that Lenz sexually and financially abused his followers. There was such a public backlash that Warner Books, the original publisher, dropped him. However, the book was then picked up by St. Martin's Press, which also agreed to publish a sequel.
Lenz promoted his book with a massive ad campaign, reportedly spending over $1 million to take out full-page ads in Rolling Stone and the New York Times. Consequently, Surfing the Himalayas was a bestseller and made Lenz even more famous.
He was now not only a spiritual leader, but also a best-selling author. He even dipped his toes into the music industry when he became a producer for a new age band called Zazen, who made 31 albums in a 13-year span.
Lenz used his money and platform to reform his public image. He gave impressive donations to many charities, supporting the ACLU, Amnesty International, and the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
But even with all this goodwill, Surfing the Himalayas had dredged up the sexual abuse allegations against him and created a fresh wave of anti-Rama sentiment. People became wiser to the cult's activities and grew suspicious about the rash of suicides the group had left in its wake.
Lenz's second book was a financial flop, but that didn't seem to bother him much. In 1998, at the age of 48, he began planning the creation of the Lenz Foundation for American Buddhism. The charity would offer financial aid to other Buddhist organizations that combined Buddhist teachings with secular American values.
But by the late 90s, his following had greatly diminished in spite of his aggressive marketing tactics. Some of his followers noticed that he became a shell of his former self around this time. He appeared thin and sick when he gave lectures, and no longer had the charisma he'd once displayed.
It all came to a head in April of 1998. 1 month earlier, the disheveled 48-year-old guru called his then-girlfriend Bryn Lacy to his Long Island mansion. The two of them had been planning a trip to the South Pacific, and she was thrilled to join him on the vacation.
But it turned out that Lance wanted to go on an entirely different kind of journey. According to Lacy, he told her he wanted them to die by suicide together so they could go to the off-world.
They both ingested a lethal amount of Valium. Lenz took 150 pills and jumped into the Long Island Sound. Lacy, however, only took 50 and therefore survived. She attempted to dive in after Lenz to stay with him, but was unsuccessful in catching up to the strong current. In a daze, she wandered back to his estate and fell asleep.
The police found Bryn Lacy unconscious in Lenz's mansion the next day, along with the two dogs that they had also unsuccessfully attempted to overdose. When Lacy gave her barely coherent testimony, the police called in divers to search for his body.
About 10 hours later, the divers located Frederick P. Lenz, Zen Master Rama. He had drowned while wearing a full suit and a dog collar around his neck.
Lenz left behind a substantial estate worth approximately $18 million. There was a battle for who would receive it, as the guru had no heirs, relatives, or wives.
Two women who claimed to be Lenz's common-law wives attempted to gain control over his fortune, but both claims were dismissed in court.
After their legal battles ended, the fight for the money only grew stranger. Both the Lenz Foundation for American Buddhism and the National Audubon Society, a nonprofit that protects birds and their habitats, claimed a right to the estate.
Lenz had apparently declared Audubon would get his money if the foundation hadn't been fully established by the time of his death. Audubon also argued that Lenz was a cult figure, and therefore the Foundation for American Buddhism was an extension of his unscrupulous practices. The court could not in good conscience award the foundation any money.
In the end, the Audubon Society settled, and the bulk of the estate ended up going to Lenz's foundation. The foundation is still functioning today and uses the money they were given to distribute substantial grants.
Since 2003, after the estate was settled, it has granted around $7 million to 100 Buddhist organizations across the country.
The foundation is just one facet of the legacy of Frederick P. Lenz. Though he seemed an innocent flower child turned high-rent life coach, his actions speak to a darker story. The tale of a man who took advantage of a spiritual movement and warped it to make himself rich.
Though many of Lenz's controversial and abusive actions are well documented, some who follow American Buddhism still see him as a positive figure. But if there truly is a karmic force, hopefully the truth of this story will outlive the propaganda.
Thanks again for tuning into Cults. We'll be back next Tuesday with a new episode.
You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Cults, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Cults on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Cults was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Cults was written by Matthew Teamstra, with writing assistance by Abigail Cannon, and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.